Okay, today we are going to review the Drush HaChadasar, the 11th Drush of the Drush HaSaran on Parsha Shoftim. In the last year, we left off the last little bit of this Drusha, last two paragraphs. That was an error. So we'll just say it at the end here. But anyway, we're going to start with reviewing the Drusha. So this is on Parsha Shoftim, and the Ran begins with the pasuk at the beginning of Parsha Shoftim, which is Shoftim v'Shotrim, Titin l'cha b'chal sharecha. There's a mitzvah that we have to appoint judges, and they should shoftu es ha'am mishpat tzedek. They should judge a mishpat tzedek, a straight, righteous, correct judgment. So Rashi understands this to mean that we need to appoint good judges. You know, no nepotism or anything like that, or picky any other reason other than being a good judge. The Ran has a different understanding. The Ran says the Shaftu is Amish Batzedek refers to something very specific, and that is as follows: that there are two types of running of society, two types of law and order that are a part of a Jewish society. A regular secular society has the government, the king. He's in charge, he runs everything. In the Jewish society, we have two levels. We have the Shoftim. Those are the Beis Din, the Sanhedrin. So they enforce what the Torah says. And that means if someone, Reuven, murders Shimon, so in order to bring Reuven to justice in Sanhedrin, or in a Beis Din, what you'd have to do is bring two kosher witnesses that say that they saw Reuven kill Shimon. They warned Reuven that he'd be killed if he tried to kill Shimon. Reuven responded, "Yes, I know, I'm doing it anyway." And only then can we kill Reuven. So that is the way it should be in a just society, in a society that is generally full of tzaddikim, because, you know, why should you kill someone unless he knows better, unless you warned him? That makes it a for sure thing. There's a lot of good reasons why you need kosher edim that are, you know, that we know the witnesses are good people. We know the person understood what he was doing. That all makes sense. But on the other hand, the Ran says, society can't really function if that's all you've got, because then murderers will be rampant. You know, crime will be out of control. So the Torah has two levels. There's the Sanhedrin. There's the Beis Din. They follow what the Torah says. Torah says, in order to kill someone, you need two witnesses, they need to be warned, hasra. So that's what you need in a Beis Din. But for society to function, we have the melech, the king. The king's job, the king, if he wants to kill someone, he does not need that there be hasra, there doesn't need to be warning. He can do whatever he wants. So the king, in order to uphold justice, the king has his own set of rules to keep the country functioning if he sees that a crime is rampant, so he can put people to death not following the Torah's laws. It's supposed to be with the right intentions, but he's not limited by needing kosher edim, that kind of thing. But we have two tiers. We have the Sanhedrin that follows what the Torah says, and that's really to keep us a holy nation, because we're following what the Torah's laws are. When the Jews act as a holy nation, when we are holy, this is ideal. And that's the Sanhedrin. And when if there's a society that doesn't work that way, it can't function that way, so then the king steps in. It's his job to make up rules that keep society functioning. Okay, and this is how this following the Shoftim, following the Torah's laws, brings Hashem Shechina to Bnei Yisrael, when we can work with them and when we use them. So that brings the Shechina to Klal Yisrael. And that's why it says, Kol Adon Din Emes Lamito, Roi Shetishra Lev Shechina. That a judge who follows the Torah's judgments, so it's fitting that the Shechina should rest on him. So having Shoftim to follow the laws of the Torah, what the Torah prescribes, when you get Malchus whipped, when there's killing and when there isn't, all that brings Hashem's Shechina, Hashem's presence to the Jewish people. And it's similar to like Karbanos, the Ran explains. Just like Karbanos, it doesn't matter if you don't exactly understand why it works. It does. If you bring a Karban, it brings Hashem's Shechina, like many other chukim. So if there's parts of why the Sanhedrin have to do what they do, why the Torah gives the laws of Sanhedrin as they are, So he says it makes a lot of sense, but if you don't like it, it doesn't matter. Following them brings the Shechina to the Jewish people. The king is only necessary just to keep society functioning. And the Ran continues that even though we find in Chazal that Onshin Shalom Min HaDin, the Chazal tell us that Beis Din themselves has a right to not follow what the Torah says, in the sense of they don't necessarily need to have kosher witnesses, or that there's a warning. If Beis Din sees that things are out of control, that crime is rampant, they can do whatever they want and kill people just to scare everyone. Kill murderers with less than what the Torah prescribes of kosher edim and witness and warnings. So, and that sounds, the Ran says, that sounds like a contradiction to what he said, because he said the Sanhedrin's not supposed to do that. They're supposed to be on that high spiritual thing, plane. So he says, one of two answers. Either Beis Din only does that when there's no king. There were times in the Jewish people's history that there is no king. So when there ever is no king, that's when Beis Din has to function on both levels. Or he gives a second possibility, that even when the king's around, it's possible that when relating to mitzvos bein adam lamakom, like keeping Shabbos, mitzvos between man and God, when you're talking about keeping Shabbos. So there, Beis Din can do the both roles, follow what the Torah says in terms of giving skila to someone who doesn't keep Shabbos. Or if they feel the need to, they can even not do it with what the Torah prescribes without being warned. Whereas when it comes to murder and crime and stealing and that kind of thing, that they only follow what the Torah says, and the king deals with helping crime stay in checked by following his own rules. So in other words, Beis Din, perhaps the second answer, saying that Beis Din may have both roles in terms of Bein Adam, roles in terms of Bein Adam Lamakom, but in terms of Bein Adam Lachaveru, they only follow what the Torah says, and it's the king's job to take care of any Bein Adam Lachaveru issues that aren't being taken care of the way Beis Din is functioning. Okay, so he says this is a famous question, that was the sin of asking for a king. We know there's a mitzvah, Som Tesim Alecha Melech, there's a mitzvah to appoint the king. And yet, when the Jewish people ask Shmuel to appoint the king, he gets very upset, and Hashem seems upset with him. And he said, tell Shmuel, don't be insulted that they don't like you. That what they don't like is they don't like me. So, but what was wrong? The Jewish people asked for a king. It's a mitzvah to have a king. What's wrong with having a king? What did the Jews sin? Again, this is a very famous question that was debated by not just Jews. Even Goyim liked to debate this, especially the founding fathers of the United States of America. Had this question. Many of them were very proficient in the Bible. They had this question, was it really a sin to have a king or good to have a king? Anyway, so Lahavdil, the Ran says that there is a mitzvah to have a king. There was nothing wrong with them asking for a king. It's how they asked, it's what they asked, why they wanted the king was the problem. They said to Shmuel, get us a king, lishaftenu kechal hagoyim. We want a king to judge us like all the other nations, meaning they didn't want the Sanhedrin taking part in any of how things were being judged. They wanted the king's, in other words, secular law, to rule over everything. They didn't want the Torah's law, because they figured that's better, society functions better with that kind of thing. So they said, who needs the Sanhedrin? Let's just have a king with regular secular laws, and that'll be better for us. And that's why Shmuel got upset. And Shmuel's response was, how could you do this? And here, Hashem can make a miracle, and he makes a miracle. So the Ran asked, what is he doing making miracles for? His point was to show them that if you follow what Hashem says, it brings the Shechina to the Jewish people. When you have a society that has a Sanhedrin, and you follow that, so then Hashem's Shechina will rest amongst the Jewish people. And look, here, I'll make you a miracle. In other words, but that when you're following Shoftim, not kings, then God's presence will dwell amongst you and will take care of any problems. Okay. So that's why we have a king. This is the Ran. This is a very famous Ran. The reason we have kings is to back up what the Sanhedrin do. The Sanhedrin follow the Torah rules, and the Sanhedrin, then the king, if society isn't functioning, he picks up the slack. He makes extra rules to keep crime in check. Okay, the next idea that the Pesukim talk about is that the judges should not take bribes. Why not? Even bribes to judge properly. You can't even take money to judge properly, because bribes are ye'averi nechachamim b'sileif divrei tzadikim. Which means that not only will it make people The Ron explains, not only will it make people not be able to judge properly, there's more to it than that. It's Ya'averi Nechachamim means that it'll make you blind, you won't be able to judge properly. V'salif Divrei Tzadikim means even if you judge properly, it'll make it look bad what you judged. If people know that you got paid by some guy, then even if you're right, it'll make people talk about you and say it's all a scam. So we have to avoid that too. So those are two reasons why the Torah is telling you not to take bribes. Then it goes on to say, do not plant trees, even on Har HaBayis, because Hashem doesn't want trees there, because the Goyim worship the trees, and even though you might plant the tree not to worship it, but the Avodah Zarah will see, oh look, they're planting trees on their holy mountain, they worship trees like us, so it'll look bad. It's the same concept like the Matzeva, which we're not allowed to make a Matzeva, which is a one-stoned altar. We have to use a Mizbeach, which has many stones. And even though the Avos used to make Matzevas all the time to bring Karbanos on, we're not allowed to because the people who worship Avodah Zarah, so they used Matzevas, and then once they used it, Hashem didn't want it anymore. And the Ron explains it's the same type of idea, because it'll look bad. It'll look like we're following them, even though that's not the case. It looks bad, so therefore Hashem doesn't want it anymore. Then it says, don't bring a carbon with any type of blemish. And the reason it says not to do that is because the Ron explains that even though I just got through telling you that anything that people who worship idols do, I don't want you guys to do. So you might think, well, people who bring sacrifices to their idols, they're very insistent on it being not having a blemish, just like we are. So maybe since that's what they do, you just told me anything they do, all of a sudden Hashem doesn't want. So maybe, just like they're very makbid, they're very insistent that the animals they bring not have any blemishes, maybe we should be insistent that it does have a blemish. So that's why it tells you, not by this. Hashem only wants sacrifices that don't have blemishes on it, because it's a bizayon, it's disgraceful, disrespectful to Hashem to bring a carbon that looks like it's run down, as opposed to the other things which have nothing to do with being disgraceful, whether you use a mizbeach, an altar with one stone or many stones, whether you plant trees, don't plant, all that stuff has nothing to do with disgrace of Hashem, but bringing a carbon with a mum would be disrespectful to Hashem, so therefore we must bring a carbon only with no mum and no blemishes. Okay, next it talks about punishing those who worship Avodah Zarah. So we have the idea of the Ir HaNidachas. The Ir HaNidachas is a city where most of the Jews there worshipped idols, and that whole city has to be wiped out. And we find three places in the Torah where it says, V'derashta v'chakarta itev, like look into it well. The three places are, one, by the Ir HaNidachas, the city where most Jews worshipped Avodah Zarah. Secondly, by people who worshipped Avodah Zarah individually, it says V'derashta itev. And three, by the third place is by Edim Zomim. Edim Zomim are people who come in and say, we saw Reuven kill Shimon, and two other witnesses come in and say about the first set of witnesses, they couldn't possibly know that Reuven killed Shimon because they were with us in a place far, far away that day. In other words, they're not disagreeing about what happened, they're just, the second group of Edom witnesses is just saying the first group could not possibly have seen it because they were with us. So the Torah says we believe that second group. So there also it says, V'derashta itev, look into it well. So the Ron explains, the reason why it says by these three things, look into it well, is because they're all three are very, very strange and unlikely to be true, therefore make sure it's true. So we can understand, Ir HaNidachas, it's very rare, incredibly rare, for an entire city of Jews to be worshipping Avodah Zarah. That's why it says, it doesn't only just say V'derashta itev, look into it well, it says V'derashta v'chakarta itev, really look into it well, because it's almost unthinkable that an entire city of Jews would be, or most of it would be, worshipping Avodah Zarah. By regular Avodah Zarah, it says V'derashta itev, look into it well, because even individuals, since Avodah Zarah is such a terrible thing, it's you have to check into it well that Jews are really doing such a thing. But the last thing is a little harder to understand. Why are Edom Zomim so unlikely? These witnesses that claim that they saw something and two other witnesses come in and say, you were never there. Why is that so impossible? Why people lie? Why is it impossible that somebody lied? So, the Ron explains as follows. Usually when people come in and lie in a court of law, they're not completely making stuff up. They're exaggerating. They're maybe adding a piece of information here. It's not quite how it is. Or at least, you know, they can point to some things because they were there and just what they said didn't happen. Here, they're making up a story when they weren't even there. So usually people don't make up stories like that because, you know, they should be afraid. Maybe somebody saw them somewhere else. They know they weren't there. And maybe two other witnesses are going to come in and say, you were with us. So to be completely so out of left field where there's no shred of truth to what they saw because they weren't even there, that's unusual. And the Ran says that's actually why we believe the second group of witnesses. Because you would think it's two against two. Two witnesses against two witnesses. Why is it that we believe the second pair more than the first pair? What makes the second two guys more believable than the first two guys? So the Ran explains, because the second two guys for sure won't lie. They're less likely to lie than the first group. Because at least the first group can say, you know, maybe they weren't there. The second group is going to be saying that the first two witnesses weren't there. Well, they really don't know. I mean, because if the second group is lying, wouldn't they be afraid that the first group of witnesses could say, what do you mean we weren't there? Harry was there. Sam was there. There was five people who saw us there. And if the second group are lying, they would know that they might be shut down real fast. Because they weren't there, and there are two people, again, if they're lying, there are two people there who said they're there, and to claim that they were with you, like, aren't you afraid that someone's going to say we saw them there? So it's less likely that they would be lying than the first group, which is more likely to lie, because maybe they knew they were alone. So that's why the second group is more likely to lie. And then the Ran explains, even though the Gemara tells us explicitly that Edom Zomim is a Chiddush, that the reason to believe the second group as opposed to the first group, really, it's only because the Pasuk says so, otherwise we wouldn't do it. So he explains that's only because the way the Torah views witnesses is we just always believe two witnesses no matter what. If Moses comes in and says, I saw Reuven kill Shimon, or whatever Moses comes in and says, and two witnesses said, no, Reuven did not kill Shimon, we don't believe Moses, even though the two people came in maybe just regular, nothing special guys. And there is Moshe Rabbeinu saying it happened, and we know we would definitely trust Moshe Rabbeinu over these two guys. Torah law doesn't work that way. Torah law says two kosher witnesses always win against less than that. So therefore, you might think two against two, which normally just cancel each other out, even though one is more believable than the other, we wouldn't have followed that. That's why the Torah says it's a chiddush to believe one group of witnesses over another. However, the Ran is trying to explain why it makes sense, because the second group should really be afraid that the first group is going to say, we weren't alone, there were a million people saw us. Whereas the first group may have known they were alone, and that's why they weren't so afraid to say something. Okay. Then the Pasuk goes on to tell, to say that if people don't know halacha, they should go to the Beis Din Yerushalayim, and you follow what the Beis Din, the Sanhedrin, says, even if they tell you your right is your left and your left is your right, which means the Ran explains that even if you know they're wrong, you know them to be wrong, you still have to follow them. And this is similar to the story of Reb Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua, where Rabbi Yeshua held Yom Kippur came out on one day, and Rabbi Gamliel held it came out on a different day, and Rabbi Gamliel insisted that Rabbi Yeshua come to him on the day that he believed to be Yom Kippur, because he wanted there has to be one Torah in Klal Yisrael, especially by the calendar, but in general there has to be one Torah in Klal Yisrael, and therefore Rabbi Yeshua, even though he believed Rabbi Gamliel to be wrong, or perhaps knew Rabbi Gamliel to be wrong, he came anyway. So he says that's what when Chazal tell us, Elo v'elo divrei Elokim chayim, which means that the Gemara says, even if you have a bunch of people learning, and some rabbis say you're allowed to do this, another rabbi say you're not allowed to do this, or some rabbis say it's Tahor, another rabbi say it's Tamei. So we say, Elo v'elo divrei Elokim chayim, they're all from Hashem. What does that mean, they're all from Hashem? And so the Ran explains what it means is that Hashem gave us the Torah. He gave the Jewish people the Torah. And there could be very different views that are both have aspects of them that are true, and it may be in heaven they actually think one guy is right, but it doesn't matter because Hashem gave the Torah us, gave it over to the Sanhedrin, gave it over to the Jewish people to decide what is correct. And that's the story of the Tanura Shalachnayim Bava Metzia, where Rabbi Eliezer said his halacha is a certain way, and if he's right, let all these miracles happen, and a ton of miracles happened. And then he said, Rabbi Eliezer said, if I'm right, let a voice come out from heaven and say that I'm right. And a voice came out from heaven and said, what do you want from Rabbi Eliezer? He's right. And the Chachamim said, we don't care. Lo b'shamayim hi. The Torah is not in Shamayim. It's here on earth. And therefore, we're not going to follow Rabbi Eliezer. So what that means is, like the Ran explains, because even though if a heavenly voice came out and said Rabbi Eliezer is right, then he probably was right. Probably he was right. So why did the Chachamim keep up with going with what they said? The reason is because it doesn't matter who's actually right. If the Chachamim on planet Earth, their brain tells them this makes sense, so even though they may be wrong, but if they see it that way, so Hashem wants us to follow what human beings paskin, what is said on Earth, what the Sanhedrin follow. Okay, so I think I'm going a little fast. I'll try to slow down. The Ran says that that's something that needs to be understood. Why would it be that Hashem would tell us to follow the Chachamim even if they're wrong? In other words, if you believe all the Torah that God gave us is all arbitrary, and Hashem said, don't eat pork just because I want to make you have something to do, or keep Shabbos just because I'm interested in you doing what I said for its own sake. In other words, if there's no point to the actual mitzvah, if all the mitzvahs from the Torah are just so that we follow what Hashem says, and it doesn't really matter what we do, if it was a mitzvah to stand on our heads, that'd be just as good. If all the mitzvahs had no point to them other than to follow what God said, then this would make a lot of sense, because God is saying, look, I think this is right, but I don't really care. I told you to follow what the Chachamim say, and once you do that, then that's just as good. So if you believe that, that's okay. But the Ran says, I don't think that's correct at all, and the mitzvahs Hashem gave us are because they're good. They're helpful to our souls, to our bar, our souls, to us in general. When the Torah said, don't eat pork, it's because pork is bad for you. And so if that's the case, how does it help that the Chachamim all came out and said a certain halacha when it's wrong? Isn't that a problem? If we know in Shamayim it's supposed to be X, that means that's what really is better for us. So if the Chachamim on planet Earth, the Sanhedrin, decide that Y is better, so Hashem says, follow the Sanhedrin. Okay, but they're wrong. In other words, if all the doctors in the world get together today and say, we're under the opinion that bloodletting is really the way, forget, all this medicine and pharmaceuticals and stuff, go with bloodletting. That doesn't make it that bloodletting helps just because everyone decided. It doesn't. If something doesn't help, it doesn't help. So if the mitzvos are not just arbitrary, they're not just listening to mitzvos just to listen, but if Hashem gave us mitzvos because they are inherently helpful to us, why would Hashem tell us to follow the Chachamim no matter what they say? If they're wrong, then we're messing ourselves up. Okay, that's the Ran's question. So, to this he answers two parts. Number one, it's worth it. In other words, the other option is, okay, everybody do what you want. Well, we can't have that either. It's very important for there to be one Torah in Klal Yisrael and everybody be following one thing. And if there was no rule like this, so everyone would follow what they see as right and everybody make up their own stuff, and it would be like millions of different religions. And we can't have that. Therefore, by necessity, we must have one unifying body that whatever they say, that becomes the halacha. And on top of that, they're usually right. In other words, we're talking about following the Sanhedrin, the smartest people in the generation, the Chachamim, who have a lot of heavenly help in what they do. So it would be unusual that they would be wrong. So if it happens, it's worth it. But it would be unusual anyway. That's part one of the answer. Part two of the answer is that even if they do happen to be wrong once, the very fact that we're following them just because God told us to follow them, that in and of itself is a mitzvah, and that helps counteract any negative thing that might have come out of what they told us, which happened to have been wrong. So between those two things, that it's unlikely that they'll paskin wrong, it's necessary that we have a rule like this. And even if they are wrong, it's mitigated by the fact that we get a mitzvah for following the Chachamim because they said so. So that all helps it not have too much of a negative effect. Okay, then we go on to talking more about kings, the Parsha does. And it says the king has to be, it's appointed by a Navi, the king has to have the Sefer Torah with him at all times, and the king can't be haughty. I forgot to mention, the Ran pointed out that the reason why this is a special mitzvah for the king to have a Sefer Torah with him at all times is because, like we said, the king follows his, you know, can make up his own rules. He doesn't have to follow the rules of the Torah when it comes to meting out punishment of people who commit crimes. And therefore, he has to have a Sefer Torah with him so he knows to stay in line. It's not like he doesn't have to keep the Torah. There's certain things he's allowed to do to keep society functioning, but that doesn't mean he has to doesn't have to keep the Torah. Therefore, he has to have the Torah with him at all times. And he also has the mitzvah to not be haughty. He can't become a haughty person. Now, the Ramban says, of course, that applies to all people too. But it's especially said to the king. Why is it especially said to the king? Okay, there's the obvious reason that a king's more likely to become haughty. But the Ram points out there's also something especially about a king that the king should think about, why the Torah is telling him not to be haughty. And the reason is because the honor that we give a king is not because we love the king and we, you know, it's part of this person that he is, be'etzem, super. The reason we give honor to the king is for the tzibur. In other words, the honor due to the king is for the honor of the population, for the people. And the king is really just a servant of the people. He's there to help the people. And the honor given to him is really for the honor of the tzibur. So he should think about that, not to think that he's so great, but any honor accorded to him is really the honor of the people, and he's just there to be their servant to help society function. Okay, then the Pesukim go on to talk about the need to give Chumas and Maisus, and the Ran explains that since the judges, many of the judges were from Shevet Levi, as it says, Yorim Mishpatach Al Yaakov, right? It was typical that Shevet Levi, the Kohanim and the Levim, they would be the Beis Din, they would be the teachers, and they'd be part of the Beis Din. So in order for the Beis Din to support itself, the king doesn't need help supporting himself, but the Beis Din needs help supporting himself. So these judges, in order to support themselves, who were usually from Shevet Levi, he says, therefore the Torah talks about Trumas and Maisos. And this way, the Kohen, the Levi, they'll have what they need. Because you give the Kohen Truma, he has food, you give him the first of your shearing, so he gets some wool. You give him parts of your karbanos, so he gets meat. So he has everything he needs. And also, occasionally, he needs other money, so occasionally there are other things that we give the Kohen, like cherem, and there are other things that occasionally, Kohanim get. So through this system of Trumas and Maisus and all the Matnas Kahuna, the Kohanim should get what they need. And they're usually the ones sitting on the Beis Din, the Ran says, so that's why it's there, and that's how you keep the Beis Din functioning. Then we go on to talking about Darchi Amori, which is generally following superstitious practices and things like that. So he says the reason we're talking about it now is also because kings are the most likely to be interested in such things, because they desperately need to know what's going to happen in the future for their wars and running the kingdom. And we're told, instead of doing that, we should be Tamim Tiyim Hashem Elokecha. We should be perfect with Hashem, which the Ran says Tamim means Shalem, perfect, whole, complete. And why are we complete? Aren't we missing astrology and all these types of things? So the Ran says, no, we're complete because we have Nevi'im. Hashem gave us prophets who actually give us true prophecies telling us what will really happen in the future without any parts of it being false. Whereas astrologers and those types of people, they may be somewhat true. They have some parts that they'll get right, but there'll always be some parts that they get wrong. So therefore, we are more Tamim because we have prophets. Okay, so the Ran says that's good with helping knowing what's going on in the future, but what about Me'onin Menachesh? Those are things that you're supposed to be able to tell, you know, when is it a good time to invest in something? Where should I walk? Where should I not walk? When should I go out? When should I not go out? So how are we going to learn that? You're not going to ask the Navi that. Navi just tells you what's going to happen in the future. But how do I know when's a good time to invest and when should I stay away from things and what's dangerous? So this is part of the magicians, the Ma'onin and Menachish superstitions. What do you do without that? So the Ran says, okay, if you hold like the Rambam, who holds this is all nonsense, superstitions are baloney, that's what the Rambam's opinion is, and so all this Me'onin and Menachish, they're baloney anyway, so we're not missing anything by not having it. But he says Chazal don't sound like that. The simple reading of Chazal doesn't sound like they believe that. It sounds like Chazal held that it did. There was something to it. And if so, if we aren't allowed to be Me'onin and Menachish, So how do we get that cleared up? Because the Navi's not going to help with that. So he says we can't be. He says his answer is that it doesn't matter, because we're not allowed to do this type of stuff, working with astrology and things like that, because we'll come to worship these things. In other words, if you know how the stars work, and you know if it's out here, it'll cause that, you'll start to think, perhaps, that the star can decide on its own whether it wants to help you or not. And you might end up coming to idol worship, offering it sacrifices. And the Ran says, of course, that's ridiculous, because the stars have no minds, in the sense that they have no choice. Just like a fire must burn, it doesn't help you sacrifice to the fire, it's still going to burn. So the mazalos, the things in Shamayim, they work, they don't have a choice in what they do. So it's silly anyway, but you might come to end up worshipping Avodah Zarah, therefore the Torah had to tell us to keep away from it. But if you're asking, what are we going to do about it? Well, he says, in mazal Yisrael, if he doesn't use those words, but if you follow the Torah, so it'll keep you that you don't have to. The Torah says many times, if you're following the Torah, you don't have to worry about things that other people need to worry about. So even if your astrology might look bad, you don't need to worry about it, because if you're following the Torah, it'll keep you above that. Okay. Fine. Then it says we should rely on a Navi, and it tells us how to know who's a fake Navi. It says if a guy says, "Hi, I'm a Navi," Hashem says the following, and I'm going to prove it to you, tomorrow it's going to rain. And tomorrow it doesn't rain, then you know the guy is a false prophet. But the Ran says it doesn't really say how we know when someone is a true Navi. In other words, all the Torah tells us is, if you want to know who's a false Navi, the way to know is if somebody tells you something's going to happen and it doesn't, he's obviously a faker. Okay. If someone says something, b'shem Hashem, that it'll happen and it doesn't happen, the guy's obviously a liar. However, what if he tells you something will happen and it does? Does that necessarily mean that he's a Navi? Maybe he got lucky. Maybe it's coincidence. Maybe it just happened. How do you know that the person's a Navi just because he prophesied something and it happened? Maybe it just happened to happen. Does that really prove anything? So the Ran's bothered. Why does the Torah not tell us how to know who is a true Navi? So he says the Rambam seems to understand that what the Torah says is if somebody makes a claim and it's proven false, that they are for sure a false Navi. The inverse is also true, that if they claim something will happen, if they make a prophecy of something that will happen and it does, you know they're a real Navi. But the Rambam says you just got to test the guy a lot of times, not just one time. He has to be proven a few times. If he says a bunch of times something's going to happen and it happens, then you can assume he's a real Navi. But just from one time, you wouldn't really know. So the Ran says he doesn't agree with that, and he thinks even if the Navi does one miracle or makes one prophecy and it comes true, we should believe him. But it's not doesn't prove necessarily, as we just said, that he's a Navi. You'll need to test him many times before you know for sure he's a Navi. But you follow him even after one time. In other words, if he does one prophecy or one miracle, then you follow him. It's true, he may not be a Navi, but in the meantime, you're supposed to follow him, and then he keeps on being tested. If you see that he's always right, then you'll know for sure he's a Navi. In the meantime, you're just doing it kind of just in case, because the Torah said to follow him. And he says that the Torah hinted to this by Moshe saying that you should make a Navi kamoni. What does it mean, a Navi like me? Then he says, because when Moshe Rabbeinu first came to the Jewish people, all he did some miracles, right? He stuck his hand in his coat and it came out white, right? He did the miracles to the Jewish people when he first came to Egypt. And it says they believed in him. So you see, that's all you need. You need someone to make a miracle and make a prophecy, and you follow him. And that's it. So that's how he explains it. And then he says, of course, Moshe's Nevuah was higher than your average Navi, because Moshe, besides this miracle that he did and all the miracles of 10 plagues, God actually came down and told us directly that Moses is my prophet, right? Hashem told all of us at Har Sinai, Hashem told every single one of us, Moshe is my prophet. So that's obviously better than just making miracles. Hashem told us directly that he's that Moshe's his Navi. But the rest of the Nevi'im, we just work with prophecies coming true or miracles. And the last question is as follows. It says, as we mentioned, that when Moshe first came to Jewish people, he did some miracles, and they believed him. But then it says, by Kriyas Yamsuf, we say this every day, and they at Kriyas Yamsuf, Vayosh Hashem, Vayom Ha'uresyo, and at the end, Vayeminu Bashem V'Moshe Avdo, after they saw Kriyas Yamsuf and all the Mitzrim drowning in the sea, then they believed in Moshe. So the Rana asks, wait a second. At the beginning, you told me when Moshe first came, they believed in Moshe. And now, only after Kriyas Yamsuf, it says again, and they believed in Moshe. So what exactly, it sounds like in between they lost faith in Moshe, and only now, once they got to Kriyas Yamsuf, once they got to the splitting of the sea, all of a sudden now we believe in Moshe. So what happened? So the Ran says, that's because there was something that the Jewish people caused them to lose 100% faith in Moshe. And that was, Moshe came to Paro, and instead of saying, Paro, Hashem says, my people are leaving, so free the Jewish people now, we're going and we're never coming back. Moshe comes in and tells Paro, we're going for 3 days. So the Jewish people thought, that's strange. If he is really the prophet of Hashem, this is not like a time of Hester Punim, isn't it? You know what? God could tell Paro, we're leaving, and we're leaving. Why would he play a game and say 3 days? It sounded to them like a bit of a scam, like he's trying to play tricks. Oh, we're only going for 3 days, or like to try to trick Paro. Hashem doesn't need to trick Paro. Hashem could tell Paro, they're leaving, goodbye, and that's it. And if you'll say, well, if they would have said that, Paro would have said no forever. No, he wouldn't have. If 10 plagues wouldn't have been enough, we would have done 20 plagues. Eventually, Paro would have broken and would have sent the Jews free. So why the trickery? Why didn't they just come in and say, Paro, we're leaving? Why did Moshe do that? Secondly, Moshe later on told them to do something strange, right? He told them before they left Egypt, go ask to borrow stuff from the Mitzrim. Now, everybody knew that the stuff that they were borrowing from the Mitzrim, they weren't coming back after 3 days, and they weren't going to give it back. So why, again, the trickery? Now, the Gemara explains to us they were entitled to that money because they worked as slaves for 200 years. They were entitled to the stuff they took. But why not just tell the Mitzrim, you guys owe us a ton of money. I'd like, you know, your stuff. And tell them straight. And the Mitzrim would have done it, as it seems from the Pesukim. So why the trickery? Why? And Hashem has to tell the Moshe, please ask them nice, because they knew, Hashem knew, you know, it wasn't the straight way of doing things. Why this backhanded way of doing things? And this actually caused them to lose a little bit of faith in Moshe. So why did Moshe do it? So the Ran explains, because everything had to be, Hashem always punishes people, mida keneged mida. You do one thing, Hashem pays you back the same way. So one of the things that Mitzrim did was to throw the Jewish children in the sea, and they drowned. Hashem wanted to pay back the Egyptians by having them throw themselves in the sea and drown. Now, if Moshe would have said, Paro, we're out of here, goodbye, forever, and then would have done the 10 plagues, and they would have left, that would have been it. Paro would have never chased after them. And if they would have said, we're taking this money, and we're leaving, they never would have chased after him. The whole reason Paro decided to chase after them is after they heard that they didn't come back after 3 days, Paro thought the same thing the Jewish people thought. That's a little scammy. If this was God, it wouldn't be done this way. And Paro therefore figured this whole thing was all a trick. I don't know how he did it. There must have been some kind of trick. This is a scam. Let's go get them and kill them. And therefore the Egyptians chased after them. And for the same reason, God made this wind. The Pesukim say this wind blew the whole night. And the wind made it look like perhaps it's the wind that split the sea, even though any thinking person would have known no wind splits seas, especially not at the 12 pathways. But it at least gave them something to, you know, oh, maybe it's the wind. It's the wind that caused the sea to split. Maybe it's more scams. Moshe's doing more scams. He's got these good tricks, but I saw the wind. Maybe that's what caused. So because the wind blew the whole night, it gave the Mitzrim something to say, oh, okay, I see this is another trick. They ran into the sea, and they were drowned. Once the Jewish people saw, oh, I get it. Look, the Egyptians tried to drown us. Now they got drowned. Oh. Then, Vayaminu b'Hashem v'Moshe Avdo. Then they believed in Moshe. Then they understood why the whole thing had to happen. And again, I would add on, personally, what I would think is, Still, why did it have to happen in a tricky way? Well, the Medrash tells us that the whole way the Jews became slaves to start with was through trickery. Because the Pharaoh said, oh, we're just going to, you know, we're going to build some new cities and we need everybody to participate. And Pharaoh himself signed up to work. And the Egyptians, so it wasn't just the Jews. Originally, Pharaoh, the Mitzrim, everybody was working. And then slowly but surely, Pharaoh backs out. And then all the Egyptians back out. And then it's too late. The Jews are stuck. So they were put into this slavery through trickery. So they were paid back through trickery. Okay. So that's that. And then, I think this is where we stopped, so I'll just read the last two paragraphs here of the Drush HaChadasar, because I never really read it. It's just a summation. Ha'olam mikol mashe kasam, what comes out from everything we've just written, and that's said. Shemitchila ha'aminu Yisrael b'Moshe al pi'osos. Originally, the Jewish people believed Moshe based on his miracles. V'imkein, k'fa yodano adeach sh'arayorai sh'yamin bo anavi. So that's the way, you see that's what's required in order to be following a Navi, to believe in a Navi. It's just that he makes the miracles and they come true. Therefore, it says, pick a prophet like me. Kolomer, what that means is that his prophecy only needs to become true like my prophecy was true to you only because of the miracles I did at the beginning. And that was enough for you to believe in me. And that which it says in Kriyas Yamsov, that they believed in Hashem and Moshe, that's as I just said, is because at the end they figured out the whole reason why everything had to happen the way it happened. Because God's ways are straight, this govern mode, very high. If someone's going to say, I'm going to figure them out, he'll never figure them out. And at the end of the day, of course, that's true. We can't really know all of why and how Hashem does what he does, but we can only figure out what we can figure out. And then the Ron ends off the drasha with an inspiring message. We see in this redemption of Mitzrayim, at the very time itself, everyone knew redemption was coming. They were getting out of Egypt. The Geula was here. They saw themselves as being redeemed. Even still, you see from the way the Ron explained this, they knew they were being redeemed and still there was just stuff they didn't get. Why this 3-day thing? Even when they were in the midst of being redeemed, they didn't quite understand how things were operating, how it all made sense. Kol shekein anachnu, certainly we, when we're talking about the eventual ultimate geula, when Hashem will finally bring us back to Yerushalayim, we are certainly not going to expect to be able to figure it out. And it's because of this the Rambam says, we will never understand and know how things are going to be until they happen. So, Bez Hashem, we should all be zocha to see the geula hasida, bimheira v'yameinu. Bez Hashem, next time we will start the 12th Joshua.